I'm Stefan Christoph in Montreal, and this is my monthly artist interview that I share on both CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and also on Radio Al-Hara in Palestine. On the program this month, I will feature an interview with author Tano Bilston about the work The Anatomist's Tale. This work weaves different historical storylines and also political histories. We go from England, where low-income people, peasants, are grappling with the privatization of common land, the commons, looking at the origins of territorial capitalism, so important for the frameworks of many points of injustice today on Earth. We go from that point to stories on ships, where people engaged in mutinies against unjust authoritarian realities on ships, pirates. We go to maroon communities, free areas in the Americas where enslaved people, people who were living under indentured labor, indigenous peoples carved out space in between power structures on the land. This is a wonderful work of historical fiction that I think speaks to some very important points to consider today. It looks at the possibilities for people to come together to create alternatives and is rooted in a historical understanding that there are many counterpoints to historical narratives of power that exclude these types of alternative historical experiences that I think can provide very important counterpoints to what we believe is possible today. So here is my conversation with Tano about his book. And this was recorded in the Umbrella House squat in New York City. This is a legalized building that was won through grassroots community struggle in the East Village of Manhattan, where people occupied abandoned buildings and demanded to have them legalized and passed on to those who lived in them. There was a number of buildings that were won in this context. Tano was part of that whole process. So we recorded this interview about his fiction work in this context. So here's our exchange.
I'm Tano Bilston. The book is called The Anatomist's Tale. It came out with Lanternfish Press in 2020. And it's a historical fiction that looks at pirates during the golden age of piracy. I was interested in looking at that period of time because I kind of see that as a time when, like, a lot of the modern world as we know it was under formation, but not fully formed. So in some kind of way, it was this liminal space or a liminal period in history when the dynamics around wage work, racism, international trade, slavery, you know, all these kinds of dynamics, gender relations, were kind of like under formation but not fully formed. So I was like interested in probing and using this sort of background of like a very, you know, kind of like, you know, pirates are this popular cultural figure in a certain kind of way, and so like using that as a space to kind of explore different things. So it's kind of an exploratory space and a meditation in certain kinds of ways is like how I approach it. Obviously there's narrative, there's all kinds of characters and things happen. And so it's, you know, yeah, those are the interests. It's around sort of exploring the space, but then also within a human space, like within, you know, characters who relate to each other. And it tells the story of, you know, well, it's told from the perspective of a narrator who kind of his own experience mirrors the experience, the historical experience that was happening at the time. It starts out with him in a tenant farmer, peasant family in England who are essentially broken up by enclosure, which was the process of enclosing the commons. These common areas that became privatized, during that period of time. And that was actually the spur to, wage work and industrialization that happened over the next century or two. So that's kind of where it starts. And then it sort of follows his arc, and then also as he observes the things that are happening around him. The other thing of looking at the screen of looking at the screen of pirates, or using pirates or piracy as a subject matter to kind of look at. It has some personal I have the personal interest because in my own personal background, I'm have lived in squatted spaces in New York City, and that was a really big thing for me since I was a young adult. I'm in a legalized squat now, but I started when I was 18, 19, living in punk rock squats and stuff like that around, which in a way was kind of this piracy. It was kind of taking and forming and creating a social formation that was kind of outside of society and figuring out. So a little bit in my head, that was the imaginative kind of source or background. But the other thing about pirates that's interesting to kind of think about a little bit is the role, the space that they fill in popular culture. Pirates, pirate captains, these kind of brutal, fellows who kind of, boss everybody around and, walk the plank and all this kind of stuff. In fact, it's a perversion of what piracy was. Piracy was in ways an early example of workplace democracy. It was workers taking over the means of production. And actually, most pirate ventures were quite egalitarian. So they were actually formed around democratic principles, although they weren't. It wasn't like that they had ideology. It was just practical. It was here we are. We're doing this thing together. And we got to do it fair, because that's the only really way this is going to work. So I don't know. I kind of wandered around your question a little bit, but that's kind of the background. You were kind of asking about the concerns that kind of went into the writing the book and stuff, and that's a little bit of the background or in the ambient stuff that's around it for me.
Activation of history, mm-hmm. And thinking about how often fictional works that have a political orientation in the sense of trying to tell a story that sort of decodes systems, mm-hmm. Which as you outlined you're doing in this work, mm-hmm. Requires this idea that there's an observation of historical patterns with your eyes wide open, mm-hmm. right? Sometimes there's a disconnect with the present when that process is happening, mm-hmm. in terms of research, in terms of writing, even fictional writing or other mediums, film, to the present, mm-hmm. right? And this idea that there can be a coexistence between having your eyes wide open in the present and being part of processes now, we're sitting in a squatted, legalized squat in East Village, Alphabet City, Manhattan, that was part of a social movement here, mm-hmm. to challenge conceptions of what property should be and how it should be run, etc. That tension between thinking about the present and the past and having an equal amount of capacity to see those, mm-hmm. systems as they unfold. Mm-hmm. There's a critique in what I'm saying in that sometimes historical work can be, people creating historical work maybe can be less engaged with the present, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but there's also a big time that's required to think about the past. So any thoughts about that?
As you were kind of asking the question, I was thinking about there's a certain point. So, the book, there's tons of historical research that goes into the book, probably more than is required. Partly it's my own, curiosity and interest, so that's part of it is I'm just oh, wow, I'm really okay. interested in this and digging into this.
Yeah.
So one of the things at a certain point, in thinking about shipboard environments and the kind of pressures that people were under, I was reading stuff about total institutions, which was from current or contemporary you know, historical research, well, not historical research, but present research about sort of what happens to people in prisons, in situations where there's like complete control, right? And the ship, you know, especially the merchant ship, organized in a hierarchical way through, you know, power that was available, you know, at the time. And then also are sort of outside of the sphere of any kind of land-based justice, you know, and sort of what happened and sort of how much the ship was a total institution at the time. But some of the stuff that I was reading to kind of reflect on that or think about it was from contemporary research into total institutions today. So I think that there is a way that the present, I don't know, there not to within the, I guess I would assert that within the vast differences of human experience over time and the wonderful, you know, like palette and array and like there's so many things that are so different, you know what I mean, between human societies across history and across time. There are also some dynamics that there are some currents that run through that we can kind of look at. So I think that the past is in the present and the present is in the past. And both are involved in the future. I'm getting Deleuzian here, but the, you know, there is this kind of like the DNA of the past is in the present,
sure,
and the DNA of the present will be in the future, and you know, and also we have some role in shaping it, you know, so it's not all determinant.
The question of agency, right, and how the narrative carries those questions. Maybe can you highlight one example for somebody who, let's get to the book a bit, like for somebody who'd be interested in engaging with your work. Maybe just an exciting example in the book where that question of like agency and shaping of autonomous democracy, whether it's a question of like sort of the points you brought up earlier of like the idea that systems are always in flux and that like power is not stagnant in the sense that it's always changing and adapting to challenges like happens on the ship. So maybe could you think of one example that could talk to that, and for somebody who's interested in reading the book, that could maybe push them in that.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the things, so, you know, the book follows this kind of like pirate venture, you know, at the end of the golden age of piracy, and, you know, the classic story of you know, unsupportable conditions, you know, on the ship imposed by a captain, a sort of uprising, and then, you know, a decision to go pirate because the, you know, essentially the sailors, you know, commit a mutiny to save themselves. And then they realize that it, even in the course of a trial, if they were to turn themselves in, they'll most of them will die in prison just waiting for a trial or justice. So they're kind of like, well, this is the only choice. And, you know, they go through, you know, a series of things that, you know, invite people to like read the book to sort of discover. And there's all kinds of stuff that sort of comes up. And they end up in this imagined space, which is kind of like which is in the book is called New Madagascar, based, which is named after a dream of another space, which was Madagascar. And in this space, you know, it's this maroon community that's made up of maroons who are escaped slaves, both from the English and the Spanish spheres, indigenous folks, and, you know, pirates and other white folks who kind of end up there. And interestingly, so I sort of like crafted this imaginative space based on one chapter of a book called Maroon Societies, I think, which is a classic book by Richard Price, and the chapter was written by there's a little sliver in the chapter where the chapter is about maroons in the United States, and there's a sliver that talks about the Great Dismal Swamp. So talking about the Great Dismal Swamp, which was this area between Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina in the United States. So I kind of took this little hint and sort of created, imagine the society. I put it somewhere else. I put it kind of in Central America in the book. Well, subsequent to that, to my reading of that and sort of my sort of imagining of that, I got exposed to a bunch of different research about the Great Dismal Swamp. And, you know, what I initially discovered as like a little sliver of an example, maybe, and imagined as this possible space, new research has showed the incredible role that the Great Dismal Swamp played as a maroon space for hundreds of years. So it was a space where people escaped to from slavery and indenture. So it was like you know, black folks who were in slavery who escaped from there and set up communities. It was also white folks who were unhappy with their circumstance who might have been indentured. And it was the descendants of the Tuscarora the Indians, who were like an Iroquois group who were in the South, who eventually actually ended up migrating up to the Iroquois Confederacy area, up in the North, like up by you, up in Montreal. So anyways, this. And so this was this space where people shared space. They had all these kinds of influences, yeah. You know, from like magical traditions, yeah. You know, African traditions, Quaker traditions, mm-hmm. Tuscarora. They had to share space in all kinds of ways and had to figure out ways. And they also seeded resistance all over the area. So there was all kinds of conspiracies and plots that were hatched and whatever that sort of came out of that space. So you were asking about agency. Yeah. And you know, I think there's other examples of individual agency also in the book. There's a little loop of a story where one of the characters asks another character who was enslaved in his childhood, when he kind of first heard about Maroons. And escaped slaves, and he tells the story not of a community but of an individual who simply in the course of his life reached a point where he no longer wanted to be in bondage, and you know, escaped into the forest, and you know, things happen, but that was another thing. So it's like marinage, or this escaping was communities, you know, it was communities who went into, you know, sometimes extremely harsh areas and try to build a way to live away from the society that was like attacking them or oppressing them. But it was also individuals who might escape for the day or permanently in some kind of way, who simply just said, I don't want to do this anymore. So those are some examples, or like ways that your question kind of like makes me think about agency and ways I reflect on it in the book.
The idea that power is also never permanent, in the sense that if you're thinking about like either the narratives of the Maroon experience or narratives around rebellion on a ship context and piracy, there's this push that often happens around thinking that power is impermeable, and like there is total control, which is interesting. When you were talking about total control earlier, I was like thinking about it. I was like, well, even in a prison, people carve out space, right? But I think that still, even within like liberal progressive narratives, this idea of the absolute legitimacy of the state apparatus being questioned is a challenging idea. And maybe even just conceptually, people having gone there, it's not even maybe super intentional, right? So can you maybe just think, reflect a bit about how through narrative you wanted to address that point of like people's capacity to create space outside of the structures of given definitions of what should be, how power should be administered, and how society should be run.
That feels like such a big question. And no, it's okay. It's like good. And it's a good question. You know, there's a way that like I really feel like this current historical period that we're in, like one of the things that is most shocking or surprising is the way that it feels so total. It feels so complete. It feels like it just fills up all the space. The system that we live in fills up all the space. And it feels like that most of the time. And at the same time, there's all these ruptures. Yeah. There's all these things. One of the things I realized, so I was in New York during Sandy when there was the hurricane. And I, you know, so I live in the East Village, Lower East Side of Manhattan. And I was really surprised at the extent to which, so we had no power down here below 14th Street. So there was this flood, came in, historic flood, it blew out the power station. There was no power below 14th Street. And there was the lack of state sort of outreach And you know, there was no vans going around saying, no, do you need blankets? You know, go to the church. Do you need batteries for your flashlights? Nothing. And this is in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. This is like the not this particular neighborhood, but this city is like the center of capital. Not to mention the Rockaways, which is kind of like an abandoned, you know, neighborhood in you know, it's like a part of the city that doesn't really get attention. The Rockaways was also destroyed. In the Rockaways, it was folks, you know, this happened maybe a year or two after Occupy Rockaway. So folks that had been involved with Occupy really organized and were out in the Rockaways very quickly. And, you know, the Red Cross was coming in and asking the Occupy people where the old ladies were and where to go, you know, for this kind of thing. But I was surprised, even I, who's like, I'm super critical, you know, in a lot of ways, I was like, oh, total power is not total. Either that, or the capacity is not there, or the interest is not there. But in some kind of way, the state didn't have an interest in projecting control and authority. And it sort of just reveals, like, there's all these kind of cracks, but maybe even sometimes we don't see them. I think that, like, on the surface, it's impermeable. It goes on forever. Yeah. It'll never end. And, you know, maybe it's disasters. Maybe it's other moments. Maybe it's moments of rebellion or resistance. There's also like incredible surprises, you know, in terms of that, when people sort of rise up. And maybe there's other ways that those cracks and fissures can get opened. And I wish for us, you know, to kind of like spend more time opening cracks, you know, and sort of focusing on that, because it's the illusion of permanence is very strong, and you know, yeah, figuring out ways to disrupt that magic. And that's a little bit what I try to do in a narrative form. You know, it's like exploring things, hopefully with stories and words. You know, I when I remember books, a lot of times it's the feeling that I remember more than like the things that were said or even the things that happened. And if I had some ambition, you know, with this book and other sort of projects, it would be to kind of curry a little bit of that feeling inside the person, the possibilities of possibilities for ruptures, for difference, for different relationships, and, you know, different ways of being in community with each other.
Do you want to highlight a point within the book that speaks to that?
Yeah, I guess that, is there a particular point in the book that speaks to that? I think that the human relations, okay, I have to, like, you caught me out, Stefan. Is there,
let's say about the maroon example,
right, exactly.
The story
yes.
of the
yes.
maroon
yes.
You know, basically the capacity there to like exist outside of power.
Yes, yeah. I've been yeah, okay, so I mean, in focusing on maroons, and really in focusing on pirates as well in some kind of way, you know, there was, you know, at the time, okay, so going back, total institutions and maybe some of the parallels between sort of maroons and piracy and these kind of like pirate ventures, because they were both total institutions in a way. Obviously, the impulses around plantation slavery, the what people, you know, people who were the owners of slaves, you know, the only way that they could dominate people was by dominating them completely, and that was something that they absolutely did. There was there was classes and workshops in dehumanization. There was people who went around and spoke to other plantation owners about how to dehumanize. On ships, the captain, you know, the authority, the ways that authority were arranged were also total. They could execute people if they needed to. They could put them into the brigs, and there was this sort of impulse towards domination that was complete. And in both of those instances, people resisted in all kinds of ways. They resisted by shirking. They resisted by loving each other in ways that they weren't supposed to. They resisted by, you know, so there's all these like minute forms of resistance too, like micro resistances that happen. And that, you know, it's like, you know, we can only speculate at the spaces that opened up inside of people at a moment of like, well, I didn't do the thing that I was supposed to, or I felt free for that minute, or mm-hmm. Whatever. Mm-hmm. I hope that you and mm-hmm. I and like everybody who listens has some like glimmer of that, mm-hmm. Of like possibility, in our own lives. So focusing on the glimmer and those glimmers of experience and of like mm-hmm. personal and collective freedom that kind of can come even in those like extremely oppressive and totalizing situations. I saw something recently, it was even something that a friend of mine posted, because partly I'm also in sort of, I have a background in social work as well and have some, mm-hmm. I'm also in some like therapy and kind of coaching spaces just personally and professionally. And somebody I know posted something about, trauma and all the focus on trauma, focusing on trauma and traumatic experiences is really important. Trauma and triggers, so this focus on trauma and triggers. And what that just little post was like, also about like, let's pay attention to the glimmers, So we pay attention to triggers, to the things that might trigger our trauma experiences. Yeah. But to also pay attention to glimmers, to the things that provoke spontaneous experiences of joy and connection, in our experience and to cultivate and nurture that kind of space as well.
Respect. Thanks for chatting today.
Yeah.
That was an interview with Tano Bilston, who is behind a really beautiful book, The Anatomist's Tale. That's out through Lanternfish Press. I would encourage you to visit their website, lanternfishpress.com, and learn more about this work by Tano and others. This has been my monthly artist interview. I'm Stefan Christoff. I share a conversation each month that looks at the intersections of art and activism in different contexts all around the world. And it's been a pleasure to share this conversation I recorded in New York City with you today. We broadcast these interviews on Radio Hara in Palestine for the first Friday of each month at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time and 5:30 p.m. in Palestine. That is streamed at RadioHara.net, and also we broadcast in Montreal at CKUT 90.3 FM on the third Friday of each month at 11:30 a.m. You can find our archives at SoundCloud.com/FreeCityRadio. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I will talk to you next month.
passé la nuit complète et je sors de moi-même contre les règles de l'état policier. À côté, le train de vie a déraillé. Je marche seul sur l'asphalte lisse de l'imagination déroutée. Midi noir, tapant, et personne ne proteste dans les rues vides. Le soleil est une radio qui perce les poumons, avec des rayons tendus du cœur jusqu'aux espoirs vains. L'invention d'un nouveau rapport au monde s'annonce comme une carte à jouer. La seule qui reste.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll listen to Hank Williams sing us all the light. Turn your lights down low, tune into the mighty power of the Country Classics Hour.
You are tuned into CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. My name is Costa Zafiropoulos. It is 8 p.m. on the dot. You're tuned into Country Classics, as you just heard. So, as per usual, we've pretty much settled in a routine. When I'm sitting in this chair, I've got a box of 45s with nothing really planned out except what I planned this afternoon. That is to say, the 100 or so 45s I pulled out, and I'll only need about 20 of them. But, you know, better safe than sorry. I've got a couple already on deck. Arlene Harden with a great tune called Lady in Waiting. But we'll start off right away with Tony Booth and Just a Man. You are tuned in CKUT 90.3 FM. You can reach me right here in the studio at 514-448-4013. 514-448-4013. My name is Costa. Feel free to call me. Let's enjoy the music. Thanks for tuning in.
They're all thinking I'm a playboy, out with a new girl every night. They don't think they can hurt me now.